Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Listener, Obscura is supported by listeners like you. If you want more bonus content, including Black Label, for those with a taste for the dark stuff, head over to patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast. That's patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Part 1. The Missing Son. Jacob and Flora Franks are deeply concerned. By 6:30 p.m. that day, the two had become worried. Bobby had always taken the time to let them know if he was going to go somewhere with his friends. This wasn't like him. Now, late into the night, they paced the house. Earlier, they checked with Bobby's friends, his school, and even the Loeb tennis court. He was nowhere to be found. At 9 in the evening, their friend, Samuel A. Edelson, arrived to provide moral support and advice. Samuel is an attorney and had given advice to Jacob in the past. He arrived at the Franks' home with a strange idea that gave the family hope. What if Bobby was locked in the school? So Jacob called the headmaster again with this new idea. The headmaster lived far away from the school, so he gave some numbers of individuals with keys. After calling around, they finally reached the school athletic director. When the group arrived at the school, they found their way in through a basement window. The key wasn't needed. This excited Jacob, but the athletic director broke the mood. If it was this easy for them, wouldn't Bobby have been capable of leaving on his own? There was a pause in the group. Still, they pushed forward. Inside the building, they shouted Bobby's name. Most of the group remained calm, but Jacob ran through the halls, the sound of his shoes thunderously stomping down the empty halls. His son's name bellowed from his mouth. It became obvious to the group that Bobby wasn't there. Towards the end of the shouting, Jacob's voice took on an angered tone. After he gave up, he stood bent over, taking in oxygen. Jacob is comforted by the small search party, and they head back to the Franks' residence. At home, Flora hears the telephone ring the second she walks through the door. She rushes to the phone and answers it with a quick jerk. A voice, with a tinny crack in the background, comes through.
Your son has been kidnapped. He is all right. There will be further news in the morning. We are killers. We mean business.
The voice on the line sounded rushed and uncertain. It didn't carry with it the tone of a hardened criminal, but Flora is too scared and upset to notice. Her son's life is on the line. She asks who's calling. Despite her best efforts, she can't stop her voice from shaking.
Name's Johnson. We have your boy, and you need not worry. He is safe. We mean business. You will know what we want tomorrow. If you report us to the police, the boy dies.
And with that, there is an audible click, and the line dies. When Jacob and the rest of the group arrive, Flora lay on the ground. She has fainted from the stress. Jacob held his wife, lifting her head, and asked her what was the matter. For a long while, Flora could only repeat the same words. My baby, over and over again. Everyone in the small search party watched helplessly. Flora eventually came to her senses. She then relayed the terrible news to her husband, that some boy pretending to be a man had their son. And this terrible boy wanted a ransom, or he would kill Bobby. At 2 a.m. that morning, Jacob Franks and his friend, Samuel Edelson, left the search party and went directly to local police. They asked to speak to Detective Michael Hughes in private. Both knew him personally. The detective wasn't in, so they spoke with a lieutenant instead. The lieutenant offered to start the investigation, but Jacob and Samuel asked to not make it a report. They didn't want Bobby to get hurt. Jacob and Samuel both shake hands with the lieutenant and are on their way. That same morning, Jacob Franks receives a special delivery. It is a letter. Jacob hasn't been to sleep. He was too worried about Bobby. He opens the letter. It's a ransom letter. It reads,
"Dear Sir, as you no doubt know by this time, your son has been kidnapped. Allow us to assure you that he is at present well and safe. You need fear no physical harm for him, provided you will live up carefully to the following instructions, and to such others as you will receive by future communications. If you fail, even slightly, his death will be the penalty. For obvious reasons, make absolutely no attempt to communicate with either police authorities or private agency. Should you already have communicated with the police, allow them to continue their investigations, but do not mention this letter. Secure before noon today, $10,000. This money must be composed entirely of old bills of the following denominations: $2,000 in 20 bills, $8,000 in $50 bills. The money must be old. Any attempt to include new or marked bills will render the entire venture futile. The money should be placed in a large cigar box, or, if this is impossible, in a heavy cardboard box, securely closed and wrapped in white paper. The wrapping paper should be sealed at all openings with sealing wax. Have the money with you, prepared as directed above, and remain at home after 1 o'clock. See that the telephone is not in use. You will receive further communication instructions. As a final word of warning, this is an extremely commercial proposition, and we are prepared to put our threat into execution should we have reasonable grounds to believe that you have committed an infraction of the above instructions. However, should you carefully follow out our instructions to the letter, we can assure you that your son will safely be returned to you within 6 hours of the receipt of our money. Yours truly, George Johnson, GKR.
After finishing reading the letter, Jacob held the paper with his hands shaking. He nearly ripped it in half. It was the tone. It seemed so calculated. No emotion. His son's life was in the hands of someone who viewed his entrapment as a business transaction. So Jacob went to the bank to get the money and the exact denomination specified. When he arrived, he asked that the bills be in worn shape. The teller, though confused, obliged this request. At the same time, Samuel Edelson went to the police station to speak with the detective, Michael Hughes. Part 2, The Big Day. May 21st, 1924. On the big day, Nathan Leopold was distracted. His instructors at the university would later note they had seen Nathan staring into the distance, his face eerily featureless, cast in shadow, staring into space for minutes at a time. Then Nathan would break from his spell and look around the classroom, as if remembering where he was. Nathan felt the electric tingle that precedes a major life event. He'd committed crimes before, but nothing on this scale. What kept turning in his mind is that the day was going so normal. Nathan ate a large breakfast that morning while the family chauffeur warmed up the Red Willis Knight touring car. Nathan knows that Richard is confident in their plan, but Richard is always confident, in that bull-headed jock sort of way. that has gotten his friend and lover through every social situation Nathan himself couldn't hack. No, Nathan knows it is up to him to remain critical of their plan every step of the way, that once things are set into play, Richard will barrel forward without a care in the world. Richard is Nathan's friend, lover, and master, but that doesn't mean Nathan can ignore his faults. They were set to murder someone, and brutally so. Everything needs to go perfect. Before Nathan finished his classes for the day, he reminded Suze and Lori they had a date that weekend. Richard Loeb stands outside of the law school casually smoking. He takes a moment to watch small commotions that tend to form on the active city sidewalk. Richard arrived early to where the two agreed to meet. He knew there wasn't a point in arriving so early. He was just so damn excited. At 11 a.m., Richard spots Nathan. He crushes out the remains of his cigarette, and they walk the short distance to Nathan's car. Nathan drives in silence. And though Richard is silent, there is a giddy, frenetic energy about him that can be felt. The two stop by Nathan's home to pick up the murder kit. The kit consisted of a thick automobile blanket, a searchlight, hip boots, adhesive tape, a bottle of ether, the bottle of hydrochloric acid, and the murder weapon, a chisel. They bundled what they could in the blanket. The hydrochloric acid and ether were carefully carried separately. Richard drops Nathan off a block away and parks the car. As Nathan walks away, Richard drums his fingers on the large wheel of the touring car. Nathan walks the rest of the way to a rent-a-car company. After leaving a $35 deposit, Nathan leaves with another Willis Knight touring car, this one with a dark blue finish. When Leopold pulls out, Loeb follows him to Kramer's restaurant. It's just after noon, and the two eat lunch together. Outside the restaurant, the two vehicles look striking parked next to each other, one with its maroon finish, the other its dark blue. After lunch, Leopold and Loeb drive back to Nathan's home. This time, Nathan takes his own car, and Richard follows behind. When Nathan arrives, he tells the chauffeur that the vehicle has a squeaky brake that is grating on him. The chauffeur tells Nathan that he'll oil the brake and to use the emergency brake for the next few days, just to be safe. After leaving Nathan's home, the two realize they have an hour to kill, so they drive to the park. Once they arrive, the two aimlessly stroll within distance of the car. There is an anxiety that comes with waiting and having nothing to occupy your mind. The sky is cloudy, and there is a slight chill in the air. After what seems like a much greater time than it actually was, the two hop back in the car after an hour has passed. The drive to Harvard seems to pass in no time when compared to the wait in the park. In preparation for the murder, Richard makes a list of potential victims. Whoever they kidnap, they want the father to have some wealth to pay a ransom. Richard doesn't need the money, but it is part of the fantasy. The blue car sits across the street from the Harvard school. Both Nathan and Richard are silent. Richard occasionally glances down at the list, as if he hasn't already committed it to memory. Nathan feels anxious. He looks more sickly and pale than he usually does, and he seems to get paler as each hour passes. But nothing about his demeanor has changed. What bothers him most is just the waiting. If he has to wait one more minute, then they spot him. Little Johnny Levinson. Nathan notes 9-year-old Johnny playing with his friend in the school playground. The boy is friends with Richard's young brother, Tommy. Johnny's father, a prominent attorney in Chicago, is more than capable of paying a handsome ransom. This makes Johnny a great mark. Nathan is lost in these thoughts when he hears the car door snap shut. He sees Richard make his way towards the playground. When Richard arrives, he makes his presence known to Johnny, but Johnny doesn't answer. Johnny doesn't like Richard. The child has a strange feeling about him. A memory comes running back to Johnny of Richard. It was when he was at Tommy's birthday party, and the two were roughhousing. On accident, Johnny knocked into a table, and a dish fell and broke. Richard took it upon himself to spank Johnny. This is normal at the time. Any adult can discipline a child if they see fit, But Johnny remembers Richard's eyes. They were eager, unblinking, and when Richard began spanking him, it is harder than Johnny's own father has ever spanked him. Johnny didn't want to cry in front of his friends, but Richard just kept going, spanking the boy until he bled. When Richard was finished, Johnny ran off to the bathroom to hide and cry in shame. Before entering the bathroom, he glanced back at Richard with an accusatory look, but Richard was just smiling. Now Richard is standing there at the park, wanting Johnny's attention. "What are you doing after school, Johnny?" asks Richard. Johnny has to look up now. Richard's eyes are that way again, eager, and he is taking deep breaths. "I'm going to play baseball with my friends," Johnny responds. "And then what?" presses Richard. There is a pause between the two. Johnny is too young to understand that he is experiencing intuition. He knows that if he goes with Richard, it would be like before, but worse. He doesn't know why he knows it. He just does. The boy needs an excuse, but before he can come up with one, the fourth grade instructor interrupts the exchange, and while the two adults exchange words, Johnny runs off with his friends, disappearing into a crowd of children. You know, listener, finances is a subject that I know some people like to avoid, but coming off of a large move myself, in which I spent in the neighborhood of $7,000 to $10,000 to move cross state, finances have been on my mind ever since. My wife and I, we've hit a point where we've realized it's time to make some serious money moves, to take control of my finances by using a Chime checking account with features like no maintenance fees, fee-free overdraft up to $200, or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. And hey, let me tell you, we've all experienced overdraft before. Chime has overdraft protection, with Chime allowing you to overdraft up to $200 with no fees. Get spotted on debit card purchases and cash withdrawals. No money fees or maintenance fees. Over 50,000 fee-free ATMs. To date, Chime has spotted members over $30 billion. Make your fall finances a little greener by working towards your financial goals with Chime. Open your account in 2 minutes at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Chime feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank, N.A. or Stride Bank, N.A. Members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in SpotMe and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Richard stomps back to the car. After entering the vehicle, he slams the door shut. Nathan breaks the silence and tells Richard that there were some other children playing on the other side of the block. They can grab any one of them. None of them would be the wiser. "No," Richard states. "There's a baseball game on 49th Street. Johnny said he'll be there." Without another word, Nathan starts the car. When they arrived at the baseball field, Nathan convinces Richard that they can't watch the game. The two would just stand out. They'd be remembered. What the two don't realize is that Johnny isn't at the baseball game. Johnny either used the game as an excuse in the heat of the moment, or knew better than to go there. When he felt his nerves well up, while under Richard Loeb's eager gaze. Hours passed, and Leopold and Loeb grew impatient. There's no sign of Johnny. Still, they would have waited as long as they needed had it not been for a stroke of luck. The catalyst for moving on is 14-year-old Bobby Franks. He's related to Richard if distantly. Bobby and his family lived on the same street as Richard. The two even played tennis together before, on the Loeb tennis court. Bobby Frank's father, Jacob Franks, once owned a pawn shop. At this point in his life, Jacob was 67 and retired from pawnbroking. Jacob invested in stocks and eventually skyrocketed in worth. These stocks were sold for an estimated $1 million. It's believed that Jacob is worth $4 million. Adjusted for inflation, that's around $70 million today. Bobby is on a walk with 9-year-old Irving Hartman Jr. At one point, Irving stops to admire some flowers. Irving never saw the dark blue touring car drive by the first time, let alone the second. The car pulled slowly up to the side of Bobby and came to a halt. Richard in the back of the vehicle, the rear door snapped open, and Bobby sees Richard sitting in the back seat. The man's stare is curious. "Bob, let us take you home." Bobby shakes his head and tells Richard there's no need. He's almost home already. "Come on, Bobby. Get in the car. I want to talk about that tennis racket you showed me. I want to get one for Tommy." Bobby is at a disadvantage. In the 1920s, you do not tell adults no, especially adults with connections to your family. Bobby takes a step, but then stops. He's not sure what stops him. Richard is staring at Bobby, the man's chin to chest, a smile spreading across his face. And his eyes. Richard's eyes are lit up like a Christmas tree. "You know Nathan, don't you, Bobby?" Nathan jerks his head back to look at the boy. He's sweating and pale, his eyes two great big white saucers with black discs in the center. He sits gripping the steering wheel while sitting up front. Bobby shakes his head quickly, "No." "Well, get in the car, Bobby. We can't sit here all day." Bobby has no choice. He climbs into the car. But once in, he feels a little foolish. He's known Richard for a long time. Bobby doesn't understand why he hesitated. Bobby sits smiling in the front seat of the car. He has no idea what's coming. "Do you mind if we take you around the block?" Richard asks from the back seat. Bobby doesn't mind. He feels at ease now. The car starts and they're off. In the back, Richard is clenching his hands repeatedly. He can't understand why his hands are shaking. Everything is going so well. Bobby clocks Nathan with a side stare. The man is pale. He has a sheen to his skin and a serious look on his face. Sweat drips from his forehead, and thin lines of perspiration trail down Nathan's neck. Before Bobby can make further observations, a hand holding an ether-soaked cloth suddenly grasps his face. Bobby tries to shout. He tries to scream. But Richard's hand and the cloth is covering the boy's mouth. Richard squeezes the ether-soaked cloth to Bobby's mouth for a while, and he doesn't understand why the boy isn't going under. It's not working like it does in the books. So Richard starts reaching around, looking for his tool, when his hand finds purchase, the chisel. Richard takes the chisel and with great force slams the wedged metallic end into the back of Bobby's skull. The crack is audible. It seems to echo in Richard's ears. But the boy is still conscious. Bobby is still fighting, his screams muffled through the ether-soaked cloth in Richard's grasping hand. This time, with as much strength as he could muster, Richard brings the chisel back and slams it down again into the boy's skull. Another sudden and snapping crack fills the car, and still the boy doesn't go down. Bobby is now convulsing. There's blood filling his hair. It's thick, like warm caramel. Bobby pulls free of Richard's hand, the cloth, soaked in ether, falling to the ground. Richard Loeb is in shock and has lost strength in that arm. Bobby can't seem to vocalize his screams as he shakes. His face contorted in a silent scream. Whether involuntary or not, the child lowers himself into the undercarriage of the front passenger seat. Richard climbs over the seat after him. This time, Richard jams the chisel into Bobby's face. At first, there's no blood, so Richard jams the metallic end into Bobby's face a second time. That second blow rips open Bobby's forehead, pushing the skin back against his skull, and blood spatters across the inside of the vehicle in a large spray. The first face wound is now filling with blood as well. It seems like there was a delay. Bobby is still conscious. He can't scream. He's no longer shaking or convulsing. He's curled into a ball crying and begging for it to just stop. Richard grabs the boy by his hair and rips him by that head of hair into the back seat. He grabs a strip of cloth and with two fingers begins jamming it into the boy's mouth and down his throat. Bobby resists some, but Richard continues to force it down his throat. He then grabs a roll of adhesive tape and he seals the boy's mouth shut. Bobby lay on the floor suffocating. Richard takes a deep breath. Nathan sits stoic, blood-speckled face, stained red trousers, driving without a word. Richard stares at his shaking hands. Listener, before we move forward, since Bobby Franks isn't going to survive this trip, I think it's worth taking a moment to spend some time covering his life. It's the least we can do since we covered his death. Bobby was one of three children, and the youngest. His sister, Josephine, 17, and his brother, Jack, 15. Bobby had brown hair with dark hooded eyes. Looking at pictures of him, the kid carried himself with swagger, wore a suit well. He was considered one of the most gifted students in his class. Bobby was a member of the debate team and, just weeks previous, took a strong stance against capital punishment. He was very much into tennis. Bobby was buried in Rose Hill Cemetery and Mausoleum in Cook County, Chicago, Illinois. After cleaning up the best they could, Richard and Nathan stopped for hot dogs and sodas. Seems murder is hungry work. On their ride to the drainage ditch, Richard sat up front with Nathan. He couldn't stand Bobby's empty stare. Richard tried to push the body over with his foot, but it had gone too stiff. The sound of the other cars rushing by had ceased. They were getting further out into the countryside. It was dark now. The ditch was at Wolf Lake in Chicago, Illinois. When they arrived, it was still dark. This is intentional, as the two don't want to be spotted. They exit the vehicle and grab a searchlight. Using it, they spot the drain pipe. It passes through a culvert. The culvert is near a railroad track. Nathan and Richard took time to remove their jackets. Nathan carefully handed Richard the hydrochloric acid. Richard dragged Bobby Frank's body out of the car and stripped him out of his clothes. Nathan looked at the boy, naked and splayed on the ground. He unstopped the hydrochloric acid. He unstopped the hydrochloric acid and began pouring a generous amount on Bobby's face. Nathan then poured a large amount of the acid on Bobby Frank's genitals. After the acid had done its work, the two carried Bobby Franks down to the culvert. Nathan put on the hip boots they brought with them and climbed into the water. The water was waist deep. Richard lowered the body to Nathan. Nathan was surprised that Bobby wasn't as heavy as he expected. Nathan carried Bobby to the pipe and tried pushing the body into the pipe. He wouldn't fit. He pushed harder this time, the strain becoming unbearable. And finally, with an audible pop, the boy squeezed into the pipe. Nathan takes some time to get his breath back. He had been terrified the boy wouldn't fit, so his heart now pounds in his chest. After his breather, with a helping hand from Richard, Nathan climbs out of the culvert. Once out, he strips out of his mud-covered hip boots. They begin walking back to the car together. Throughout the whole of the murder and its cleanup, the both remain quiet throughout most of it, only breaking silence to suggest actions to accomplish a task at hand. We can't possibly know what went through their minds when walking back to that car, but I like to imagine that this is when some level of inflection passed through their mind. Things had become real. The two had murdered a teenage boy, desecrated his remains, and hid the body. Their life, as well as their victims, had changed forever. There was no going back. Richard and Nathan don't bother to keep pace with each other on the walk back to the car. Occasionally, one will stop for a moment and stare at nothing in particular. They both still found themselves traveling that same dark road. No physical separation could change that. Richard stops to stretch his back. He puts his hands at his side, cranes his neck back, and stretches his lower stomach forward. He then hears an unmistakable tink sound of something metal hitting the ground. Had something fallen out of his pocket? Nathan was ahead, now carrying the searchlight. Should he call him back? No, it was probably nothing. After finishing the ransom call to the Franks' residence on a payphone, Richard and Nathan drive to Nathan's home. When they arrive, the pair have a drink with Nathan's father. Just before midnight, his father leaves the pair to lay down for bed. After making love, Leopold and Loeb sit for a moment, thinking about the past hour. They had called the Franks' residence from a payphone. After the call, they jotted down the address to send the ransom letter. They had burned Bobby's clothes in the furnace. Richard stood at the furnace, blanket-wrapped clothes in hand. There was something in him, telling him not to throw the pile of blood-stained clothes into the fire. Something awakening in him that he couldn't quite understand, couldn't quite get a grasp on. Some inner voice that told him he should keep them as a sort of memento, a trophy, that when later, after there was more, he can have these to look back on and no, that was stupid. He didn't want to get caught. He's too intelligent for that. Richard had read all the mystery greats. He knew what the police looked for. Before tossing the pile in, he took one last moment to look over the clothes. He pressed his face deep into the bundle and took a deep breath, reveling in the smell. The clothes excited him. They smelled of copper. He could see the rust-red stains on them. Was a sock missing? His heart sank. How had they made such a stupid mistake? They were so thorough. Was it because his hands had been shaking? Richard knew he wasn't this careless. Richard tossed the clothes into the fire without another thought. He reassured himself. It's just a sock. What knowledge could possibly be gained from a sock? Nathan offered to drive Richard home, and Richard accepted. While Nathan drove, Richard sat in the front seat, eyeing the murder weapon. The chisel had Bobby's blood on it. This brought a rush of excitement to Richard. Should he keep it? No, he'd been through that. He couldn't slip up now. He had to stay smart. Richard threw the chisel out of the car window, and it landed with a clatter on the side of the road. The instrument of death. The same tool that had fractured Bobby's skull and gashed his face. Without its practitioner, the chisel lay blameless. And out of the dark stepped a night watchman. Bernard Hunt watched the red Willis Knight disappear into the dark. With a slow stride, he walked over to the chisel on the road, and he eyed it. He picked it up, rotated the tool in his hand, and noted the blood stains. As a night watchman, Bernard had seen his share of illicit behavior. There was something obviously wrong about a blood-stained sharp instrument. Bernard put the chisel in his pocket and walked back into the dark.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.